Last weekend, during our online, or during our worship gathering, someone in our online community confessed Jesus as Lord and Savior and became born again. This is a good word. It's a good word. And you know, just this past week, we have celebrated Veterans Day. How many veterans we got right now in here? Yeah, handful. Thank you. So I have some veterans in my family. I have veterans in my family. I'm very proud of them. I come from a long history of veterans. In fact, if you were to go to my blog, you could read a simple story about just the legacy that I get to stand in. Let me introduce you to some of the veterans in my family. All right, so here we go. This old guy, you see this guy? This is Janiah Franklin St. John. All right, it's my great, great, great grandfather. And he was from Ohio. And he was part of the 75th Ohio Volunteers, joined with General Sherman's army, and made his way, Union soldier, made his way down through the South. He burned Atlanta. Sorry, all you Georgians. And he went on over to the coast with the armies, made their way up, and were part of that pincer move that brought a crushing blow to the slave democracy of the Confederacy, which was vile. And I am so proud of this, my great-great-grandfather. I have his letters, his handwritten letters that are in my office at home, and I've got his gun that he carried into battle. And it is a treasure in my life. So that's Janiah Franklin St. John right there. And then this next guy right here is my dad, the greatest man alive. This is Bob St. John. He was part of the 720th Military Police Battalion. He served in Europe and then was in stationed at Fort Hood, Texas, where during the time of President Lyndon Johnson being president, he would go down to his ranch in Texas for little getaways. And my dad was part of the security team that helped make sure that President Johnson was safe. You, of course, recall this is right on the heels of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And so security measures for presidents, it was an intense time. And Dad was right in the middle of some of those experiences. He left the Army, was a police officer in Berkeley, California. Thank the Lord for our police officers. He went on, was a police officer in Columbia, South Carolina. And then he became a special agent with the Treasury Department fighting terrorism before any of us ever even heard of the word. And those are stories for another time themselves. And then this next guy is my wife's daddy, also a great man, Thurl B. Robertson. And here he is in his Marine uniform. He fought in the South Pacific during World War II. He was a tail gunner on a B-25 Mitchell. He's 96 years old. He's still alive. He'll be 97 in March. And he is kind of ticked off that God still has him around. I'm ready to go to heaven, he says. How come he's making me wait? And so, you know, here he has outlived most of his friends and two wives, and he's really ready to see Jesus. But we're thankful for him. He was part of the 620th Marine Bomber Battalion and also saw action at places like Iwo Jima. And I know of no man that knows as much scripture as that man right there. This guy loves Jesus, as does my dad. Great men, wonderful veterans. So let's give it up for our veterans again here. Now, it was a certain Tuesday when Jesus was there in the temple precincts in Jerusalem, days before his crucifixion. And a large crowd is gathered and is pressing in around Jesus. And as they are, things are getting tense. The religious leaders are anxious because they see Jesus as a threat. One of them, whose motives are a bit questionable, from the back of the crowd yells out to Jesus, "Teacher!" "Yes," Jesus says to him. "What is the most important command?" Now, you and I might think the most important command in the Bible, and that would be fairly close. This is what was generally being asked, although they didn't have the Bible like we have it today. They had what was called the Law, or the Torah, which is the first five books of the of what you and I call the Old Testament. They had the prophets, and then they had the Psalms and such. And so when this question's asked, really the question is, what's the greatest command of God's law? And Jesus answers, and he says this, Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, and all your strength. And then love your neighbor as you love yourself. This is the greatest commandment. This is what Jesus says. We find this in Matthew chapter 22 and in Mark chapter 13, 12, something like that. And here you have Jesus make it really clear. Notice, all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength. Notice the all. It is an all-in proposition to love God and to love those around us. Now, I want you to hear me. Please hear me, friends. Love demands that we not use half measures or be hesitant. We cannot be half-hearted with love. We cannot be half-hearted with love. We cannot be hesitant with love. It requires an all-in attitude in every area of our existence. Every area of our existence. Love matters. We wonder, how can we love really well? What might it look like? What could be an example for us? Foreigner, those great theologians, asked this in their epic rock ballad. I want to know what love is. I want to feel what love is. I want someone to show me. And indeed, we all get that. We all want to know, what is love? What does it look like? How might we step into it, give it, receive it? Now, the Song of Solomon is a better epic ballad. It is a poetic masterpiece. There are few written pieces anywhere in history like it. It is tucked away right in the middle of our Bibles, and therefore it has the authority of God Himself. And it is a story, a love story of a young woman and a great king, Solomon. And it's more than that. It also is a message about longing, about being seen, about celebration, and real talk. It is a book that is also sexual in nature. Sexual in nature. And so what we see is this young woman and this king, King Solomon, much of their love story is told through the expression of sexual intimacy. Now, I want to be really clear. It's not the only way that their love story is told. It's not the only way that love is made manifest in the Song of Solomon, but it certainly is one of the primary features of the Song of Solomon, this expression of sexual intimacy. Now, let me invite you to do something with me here. And I failed to do this in our last hour. I should have anticipated it. I want you to hear me. The spiritual warfare around this discussion is so intense, ranging from really struggling to get through the message in the last hour to instant criticism. How dare you talk about this in the house of God? The service barely over. Friends, this is God's treasure. These are God's things. And it would help me a lot if we just prayed as we continued here. And oh, that I wish I had anticipated that. However ready one might feel going into the last worship service. If you've not paid attention to the Song of Solomon, I urge you to do so. Some of you are stepping into this, and it's brand new to you, and this might be your first day, and I would encourage you to go back and watch the recent messages. Go back and pay attention to them. And I would encourage you to reread and reread the Song of Solomon. And what you'll note when you do is among the treasures that are there is indeed this rich sexual expression, this intimacy between the woman and the man. And they do not hold back in their picturesque representation of this. Now, what I want you to hear is their sexual expression is rooted, it is anchored in the depths of genuine, loyal love. Love is the soil in which the roots of healthy sexual expression grow. And it ought to be that way. It is really the only way it should work, and the only way ultimately in a healthy dynamic that it can work. When we look at the Song of Solomon, we see, in fact, the power of this love as the soil, if you will, for even sexual expression. Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verses 9 and 10, find King Solomon talking about this love. He says, "You have captured my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice." And then he goes on, and you can read the sensual things that he offers. We might also read in Song of Solomon, chapter 8, verses 6 and 7, these famous words. This is from the woman's perspective. "Set me as a seal upon your heart," she says to her husband Solomon, "as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised." And so here you have these two affirming the depths of their love and all the expressions of that love in the Song of Solomon, including sexual expressions, are rooted in this love. And so this is instructive for you and me. We learn here something about the nature of love, and we'll talk more about that in a few moments. But before we talk about that, and I will tell you straight up, here's where I sensed the turn the previous hour. Before we talk about that, then let us process together some practical wisdom about sex, sexual intimacy. And there are a small handful of things that I would love for you to hear. One of them is this: sex, as it is portrayed right here in the Song of Solomon, as it is portrayed here, is, listen to me now, one man, one woman, before God, and a covenant marriage. This is God's design and his desire for sexual intimacy. One man, one woman, before God, covenant marriage. Now, some of you will say, "Well, now, Pastor, Solomon is not the standard bearer for when it comes to sexual intimacy." I mean, and that is true. This man, he was all over the map. As the years went on, he made a mess of his life. God love his heart. He made a mess of things. And the pain and the trauma of his choices lingered for generations. Generations. At the end of his life, experiencing God's grace, he could celebrate it, but the pain along the way. So you're right. Listen to me. You're right. Solomon is not the standard for healthy sexuality and sexual intimacy. But I would say to you, neither is this woman. And it's not because we have any indication that she's a righteous person or an unrighteous person. Here's the rub. Listen to me. The woman and the man were not meant to be the standard. The standard is God's desire and design. That's the standard. The woman and the man, at any point along the way, may or may not rise or fall according to what is God's best design. God's best design and his desire is the pole star. That is the standard for human sexuality. And his desire and his design is one man, one woman before God in a covenant marriage. Now, some of you will say, well, Pastor, well and good, except Song of Solomon is descriptive and not prescriptive. It is describing the love story of this random man and random woman. And it's Old Testament, by the way. And now we live in the modern era. We're New Testament people. Anything goes now. We have freedom and there's no end of fluidity in how we see life, and everybody can come to the table with their own worldview and so forth. And I would say that that is profoundly naive and intellectually dishonest. Because when you look into the scriptures, you see no less than Jesus himself offer the clarion prescription for sex and marriage. We see it in Matthew chapter 19. So in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus is confronted by the religious leaders who are questioning him about divorce and marriage and relationships. And in verse 4, Jesus says to them, have you not read, i.e., go back to the scriptures, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And he said, therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. And so what we have here is Jesus making it crystal clear what God's ethic is regarding sex, sexual intimacy, marriage, and so forth. And he's rooting it back to the very beginning, Genesis chapter 1, Genesis chapter 2. And this is Jesus affirming what has been a timeless ethic for millennia, and rather than fudge on it or make it fluid or change the rules, if you will, Jesus affirms it strongly without any qualification. And I want you to note how incredibly relevant it is to our day and age when anything goes. Multiple genders, multiple views on sexual relationships, and so forth. Jesus affirms, and it is crystal clear, he has taken his cues from his Father and from the Word. There are two genders, male and female. There is not male, female, and then dot, dot, dot. It's not part of God's design or his desire. Additionally, we see that when it comes to sexual intimacy, it is one man and one woman coming together to become one flesh. It's not one man and one man. It's not one woman and one woman. It is one man and one woman coming together. This is the voice of Jesus echoing the timeless vision and values of his Father, rooted in the very first verses of the Bible. Additionally, we see that they come together as one flesh. And what I want to do to highlight the beauty and the joy of sex is to let you know that that consummation together is what makes the marriage. It is not the preacher on the platform wishing well the couple. It is, that's nice and all, but what it is in fact when they come together as one flesh. That consummation moment is the moment when the marriage has come about. And that shows you the beauty and the power of what sex is all about and why stewarding it well is so critical, so important. Additionally, we see that God sanctions this, and so they come together according to what Jesus writes, what therefore God has joined together. It's his sanctioning. And notice, let no man separate. And the idea here is that the community is going to be part of the accountability process. So you have the two genders coming together exclusively, man and woman. They come together. They consummate their relationship. That is sanctioned by God as their marriage. And I would add at this point then, the community is a public witness to this and celebrates it. And so you see accountability. You see sanctioning. You see clarity on gender and on the sexual relationship and the prominence of marriage as the means by which sexual intimacy is enjoyed. Now, all of that is one statement about sex. The second thing I want to mention about sex is it is something we're celebrating and anticipating. It's not to be dreaded. It is not something for which one should be ashamed. And it's not to be stewarded stupidly. It's to be managed responsibly and beautifully and joyfully and thoughtfully. In Genesis chapter 2, verses 24 and 25, we see at the tail end of that chapter, in those two verses, Adam and Eve have now been created. They've come together. And according to the text, it says that they were together, they were naked, and they had no shame. Isn't that incredible? The freedom, the safety, the beauty, the joy. That's God's design and God's desire for sexual intimacy. No shame, no fear. Oh, what joy, celebration, anticipation. And if only we would cast that vision with our kids, with our grandkids, with our neighbors. If only we would cast that vision with our spouses and not shackle the people around us with all the shame narratives that have been handed to us. Oh, that we could cast God's vision and move well past earthly narratives of doom and gloom and shame and dread. Now, a third item about sex. And if you hear nothing else today, please hear this one. Sex satisfies deeply, but not completely. Did you hear that? Within the confines of a covenant marriage, one man, one woman, before God, covenant marriage, sex satisfies deeply, no doubt about it. But not completely. And it was never intended to do so. But that's one of the great challenges in our world today, where sex is treated as the end all be all of everything. It does satisfy deeply, but not completely. It was never intended to do so. Only Jesus satisfies us completely. Only Him. Only Him. What sex does is it whets our appetites for, listen to me, for greater delight, greater glory, greater love. It is, as it were, a parable, a paradigm of what more expansive, deeper, broader, more resilient, intense love can be. It sets the stage for understanding the fuller depths of eternal love. So, therefore, then, it becomes instructive and inspiring. Now, those are some reflections on sex, but let's lean into the ways it instructs and inspires as a model for deeper love. And so here, the apostle Paul is really helpful. In Romans chapter 12, which I would submit to you is one of the most pivotal chapters in the entire Bible. Romans chapter 12, verse 9, we see the apostle Paul write this: "Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor." Now, that word outdo one another, that phrase, it's an extremely rare word. It only appears one time in the entire Bible. And it literally means this: lead the way with command. Now, I want you to think about the implications of that for how you love. Do you love with command? With that kind of intentionality, that kind of intensity, that kind of leadership, Do you love like that? Do you outdo the people around you, if you will, loving really, really robustly, leading the way with command? That's what the text means. Love demands intensity. Now, I don't mean the high school crush kind of intensity, which is really about this roller coaster of emotions. And one day it's, oh, it's so intense, he looked at me. And the next day it's oh my goodness, he thinks I'm awful. That's not the intensity I'm talking about. I'm talking about intensity that betrays a resilience, a drive that is about scope and scale, that is about determination and will. That's what I'm talking about. And we see the Apostle Paul dive more deeply into that kind of love in the famous love chapters of 1 Corinthians 13. Actually, the very last phrase of 1 Corinthians 12 offers this: I will show you a more excellent way, the Apostle Paul writes. And then in verse 1 of chapter 13, he unpacks what is one of the most famous passages of literature in all the world. He says, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have and I deliver up my body to be burned but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. Are you listening to these? It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. And you can read the rest. Now, by the way, I have stood on platforms now for nearly 3 decades and recited this biblical passage at weddings. But it's not a wedding passage. It is a disciple passage. This is how followers of Christ ought to relate to the world around them, no matter who it is. No matter who it is. Now, I have to ask you a question. And the question is this: how are you loving those around you? What does it look like for you to really love like Paul is talking about here, without arrogance, without resentment, patiently, with a sense of grace, tenacity? What does it look like for you to love like that? Can you love like that? Do you love like that? What about your wife? Do you love her like that? What about your husband? Do you love him like this? What about your kid, even if he's a prodigal? What about your employer? Yeah, that guy. What about the immigrant or the refugee? Despite all the narratives in our favorite cable TV channels, are you willing to love that person like this? See, these are hard things we have to wrestle with. If we really want to know what it looks like to love, we have to deal with those hard questions. How far am I willing to go loving the people around me? What does it look like to lead the way with command and to outdo as a lover of people? You see, the couple in the Song of Solomon, they were all in. And their sexual expression reveals that. They are committed to each other. They are outdoing each other in their love for one another. And we extrapolate that well beyond just the sexual relationship, and we think about spiritual relationships, social dynamics, emotional connections, work, family, public square. What does it look like for us to really love like that? And do you love like that? And what say those who know you? What would they say about you in this regard? Now, the Song of Solomon is indeed a love story between this young woman and this great king. And as I've already articulated, It is a sexual book. It is a text on sex and on God's design and desire for such in our lives and how it can look according to His prescription. It is also, as we've acknowledged in recent weeks, a book on the love of Jesus and His people for one another. Listen to me, friends. Jesus is the ultimate standard bearer on perfect love. Did you hear that? He is the ultimate standard bearer on perfect love. And so looking at His life helps us to love well. Looking at what He does is instructive for us. Now, the Apostle John gives us a sense of how Jesus embodies love. John, or rather, 1 John chapter 4, verse 7 and following. Listen to what it says. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God. And whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love. In this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent His only Son into the world so that we might live through Him. In this is love, not that we have loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the atoning sacrifice for our sin. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God. If we love one another, God abides in us and His love is perfected in us. His love is perfected in us if we're with Him. Now, the Apostle Paul amplifies this in the book of Philippians in chapter 2. The famous kenosis passage. Verse 4, we read these words. Let each of you look not only to his own interest, but also to the interest of others. Have this in mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though He was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied Himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, He humbled Himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even a cross kind of death. He got over Himself, if you want to say it that way, set aside His rights, set aside His privileges as God, so that He could die a sinner's death for you and me. That's love. That's love. The Apostle Paul elsewhere speaks even further about the love of Jesus and how it is manifested. And it is instructive for us. In a passage in Ephesians chapter 5, we see the apostle talk about marriages. Talk about how a wife relates to a husband relates to the wife. According to verse 21 of Ephesians chapter 5, they are to submit one to the next. We're to submit to each other out of love and reverence for God. We get to verse 25, and we see here God's love demonstrated this way, that husbands ought to love their wives as Christ loves the church. Let's listen to the text as a whole here. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25 and following. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her, that He might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word. That's the word of God. That He might present the church to Himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Someday, Jesus, before the Father, is going to bring the church forward. Father, here's the bride. Oh, what a day that'll be. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church. Let me stop there. When I look at this passage, I'm struck, and it's haunted me forever, as a husband, as a father, and more than that, as a man, as a disciple, as a child of the living God, redeemed by the blood of Christ. I ask myself, if Jesus loves the church, and I'm to love like him, how did he love the church? What did he do? What does it look like? And the text tells us. And there are some things that we learn on how to really love in any area of our lives. Sexual, back to the Song of Solomon. Social, emotional, relational, spiritual, workplace, school place, wherever it is. We learn from Jesus, and here's what we see. Here's what we see. Number one, pursue others. Pursue others. There in verse 25, it says here, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. The word for love is the famous agape. And it has nothing to do with feelings or emotions. It's about an act of the will. It is me making a determined decision to love. It is a choice of the will. It is a commanding decision. If I manifest agape, I am not responding based on emotions, but on a determined decision to give love away, to give affection toward another human being. Regardless of whether I feel like it, regardless of whether it's deserved, Jesus came to us, we didn't deserve it. He pursued us even though we are so unworthy. And that's the way it is in marriages. That's the way it is in any common relationship. We're all unworthy on some level or another. But agape love means we'll pursue the other anyway. Did you hear that? You mean even if they don't vote like I do? Even if they don't look like I do? Even if they don't sound like I do? Even if they don't have the kind of degree I've got or the money I have? Or go to the church that I'm a part of? Yeah, you love them. You pursue them. That's what agape is all about. And that's what Jesus, that's what the Christmas story is about. It's the incarnation. Jesus showing up on the scene. Secondly, not only do we pursue others, but we put aside ourselves. Or another way to put it is we get over ourselves. And it's not to say we don't have good boundaries. We need those in life. But as a general principle, we're other-centered. We set aside ourselves. We sacrifice. And this is what Jesus did at the cross. I just referenced Philippians chapter 2, where Jesus, he sets aside his rights and privileges as God to die a sinner's death on a cross. Talk about other-centered. Talk about setting aside his own glory, his own ambition. Talk about humility. This is what Jesus has modeled, and it ought to be the posture we have. It ought to be the posture we have. And so it is. In John chapter 15, we see these beautiful words. Verse 13, it tells us this. Jesus says, greater love has no one than this, that someone lays down his life for his friends. Are you that kind of person? Willing to go all out sacrificially to honor someone else and raise them up? This is the gospel lived out. Jesus lived a sinless life. He died having been betrayed by friends. He died on the cross, having been tortured, shed his blood there so you and I could be free, rose from the dead, he ascended into heaven, he's seated at the right hand of his Father, pleading with his Father on behalf of his followers, so that sin, death, and the devil no longer have the final word. This is good news, amen? And this is what love does. And it ought to be the posture we have too. A selfless, other-centered, raise up the other kind of love. Number three, we need to embody and promote dignity. Embody and promote dignity. I want you to listen to these words here from Ephesians 5. Listen to these, beginning in 26. that he might sanctify, cleanse, wash, splendor, present with splendor, spotless, without wrinkle, holy, without blemish. Let me ask you a question. Is the way you treat the people around you, does it create that kind of safety? That kind of safety, that kind of space, that kind of honor where the people around you, they feel free, pure, holy, seen, cared for, lifted up? According to the text, and I referenced it, I echoed it a bit ago, someday, listen to me, someday Jesus is going to take us and present us to the Father. Lord, here's the bride, the church. And if we really believe that husbands are to love their wives as Christ loved the church and Jesus is the example, then you might imagine with me for a moment the idea that one day a husband will stand before the Father and the Father will say, all right, son, bring forward that woman to whom you were married. And is he going to see pain in her eyes or joy? I want you to wrestle with that. And what if, by chance, the Lord just says to you as a disciple, apart from marital relationship, hey, you, my disciple, bring forward the people that you had opportunity to love. Bring them forward to me. And what's he going to see in their eyes? Is he going to see pain or is he going to see joy because of how you have related to them? Does your love, is it so intense, so robust, so intentional that the people around you have joy? They feel safe with you. They're known, they're seen, they're honored, their humanity, their image bearingness is dignified. Or is there another narrative at play? You see, if we're really going to love, we need to be people that are creating safe spaces for those around us in which to flourish as human beings. Kids, spouses, classmates, co-workers, you name it. And by the way, let me add, this is profoundly innovative in a culture that is filled with nothing but rage. You'll be the most innovative person around you. Fourth, prize others. Celebrate them. Honor them. Cherish them. Nurture them. That's what the text says. The husband needs to love his wife in such a way that he nourishes her and cherishes her. These are words of tenderness. Can I just say, there is some really bizarre narrative in the evangelical church today that downplays tenderness and gentleness and nurture as something weak and exclusively feminine. That is a lie from the pit of hell. Jesus is the ultimate portrait of strength and at the very same time leverages that strength to be extremely tender and caring and grace-giving. We need to prize people, cherish them, nurture them. It's about building them up, not tearing them down. Anybody can tear something down, but it takes real strength, real courage to build something up or someone. In the Song of Solomon, this couple, they embodied these kinds of things in their relationship, sexual and otherwise. Intentional, selfless, safety and purity, cherishing and nurturing. And Jesus embodies it most chiefly. And therefore, we see that kind of love is not just for the bedroom, but for the boardroom and the classroom and the locker room, the family room, the dining room, and where there is no room. The Apostle John puts it this way, very simply. 1 John 3:16. By this we know love, that Jesus laid down his life for us, And we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers and sisters, for those around us. And we do that because he first loved us. Oh, how he loves us. You go love like that.